Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program of economic analysis, looking at our jobs, our incomes, our debts, our futures, in terms of the goods and services we have available, the prices we pay, our taxes, all of that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I teach now at the New School University in New York City. I also write columns of economic analysis for such institutions as truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis every day. Check them out at truthout.org. As usual, I also invite you to look at either of the two websites we maintain. If this kind of program interests you, if this kind of analysis is something you want to know more about, then visit our websites. They're available to you free 24/7. The first one is rdwolf.com. And the second one is democracyatwork.info. In addition, both of those websites offer you two other opportunities. The first, communicate with us. Send us your questions, your comments, your criticisms. We read them all and shape this program in response to your interests. And finally, both websites offer you a way to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and thereby keep in close touch with all the activities that swirl around our project. Let's begin today's short economic updates by talking about the small town of Dyess, D-Y-E-S-S, located in the state of Arkansas. Why? Well, something remarkable happened in Dyess, Arkansas, back in the 1930s, and it's back in the news today. And that's why it's interesting for us. Back in the 1930s, the Great Depression of the United States led to a movement of working people in something called the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, working together with two socialist parties and a communist party, all strong here in the United States at that time. And it led to pressures on the government to really do something to help people work their way through the awful horrors of the economic deprivation of the Great Depression from 1929 to 1941. And one of the things the government did that I didn't know about, and I thought perhaps you didn't either, was to help families in rural areas, farming folk, in a way that surprised me. So here's the simple, basic information. The government formed something then called the Dyess Colony, D-Y-E-S-S, in what is now northeastern Arkansas. The state government in Arkansas, the federal government working through Arkansas, took 16,000 acres reclaimed from a swamp and carved them into 20 or 40 acre homesteads. The federal government undertook all the expenses of reclaiming the land, carving it up, surveying it, all the rest. Then the government also undertook the expense of clearing 2 acres in each homestead to put up a house, a barn, a chicken coop, and an outhouse. We're back in the 1930s, after all. And then it was up to the residents to clear the rest of the land, grow a crop, and begin to pay off the mortgage, the small debt that they had to incur to become one of the owners of these plots set up by the federal government. It helped thousands and thousands of families get through the Depression. It was a kind of government program, not from the top down working through banks, but from the bottom up working through the people who clearly needed it most. And why is it in the news today? One of the families whose own members today say, quote, "My family was saved by the WPA." That was the program, part of the New Deal under Roosevelt, that organized and operated these colonies. And there were many, many of them across the United States. Well, the family in question that is bringing all the attention is the family of the famous American singer Johnny Cash, because it turns out that Johnny Cash was born and raised in Dyess Colony. His family was saved. His life, perhaps, his spirit, that which made him so great a singer and so great a contributor to American culture, had something to do with getting help from the United States government at a time when it was possible for the government to really help folks at the bottom, which is unlike our time today. A remarkable tribute to a past period of time saved for us because Johnny Cash and his family know how important it was. Hats off also to Arkansas State University for spearheading the effort to reclaim and rebuild this community so it's available to people, and all those who want to go to where Johnny Cash grew up will now learn something about American history they probably didn't know and wouldn't have learned any other way. The second update for today is really short, but it's really to the point. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in a piece of analysis produced on the Bloomberg Financial News Service and released by them on August 19th of this year, during the period from 2008 to 2012, that's when we were coming out of this so-called Great Recession that we're really still in, here are the numbers according to the government of the United States. The top 20% of American families saw their incomes grow by an average of $8,358 a year from 2008 to 2012. Let me be clear. During this Great Recession, the top 20% saw their incomes rise over $8,000 a year, even though we were in a recession. The bottom 20% saw their annual income decline by $275 per year. You couldn't have a starker statistic about the difference in this so-called recession between those at the top whose incomes continued to rise and at a nice clip, and those at the bottom whose incomes declined. Now, what does that mean and what does it suggest? Well, over the last period of 2008 to 2012, with a couple of exceptions, the American economy grew. The total output of goods and services grew. The pie was getting larger. There are some people who believe that we can deal with our economic problems by making the pie larger, because if the pie gets larger, well, everybody's piece, even those with a little piece, their little piece gets larger too. What these statistics show us is over the last 5 years, 2008, 2012, all those years included, the pie got larger, but the piece for the little folk, the poor folk, got smaller. All the gains of a big pie, of a pie getting larger, went to the folks at the top. It's a good reminder that making the pie larger, having economic growth, is no antidote to inequality and no solution for our economic problems. One of the reasons the so-called recovery in the United States is bypassing the vast majority of people is that what's recovering is economic life for the 20% at the top, if even that many. Most economists think it's limited to the top 10%. Well, whichever way you go, it's 80 or 90% of the people that are being bypassed by this recovery. Economic growth is no solution to the problems of our unequal society. I want to turn next to what several of you have emailed me and asked me to talk about, and obviously I know why. It has to do with Ferguson, Missouri, a place in our country that exploded over the last couple of weeks. It was an explosion building over many, many years. That's perhaps the most important lesson for us to learn. Why? Because if, as almost everyone agrees, the grievances of the African-American population of Ferguson have been building for a long time, as their economic, political, their whole social situation has deteriorated. If likewise the overreaction of an overstressed police department have also been building for a long time, as the budgets for the police are squeezed, as the social conditions they're asked to cope with become more difficult, as the level of attention and training to them deteriorates. You put all these things together, we know it's been building for a long time. We also know, unless we keep our heads in the sand, that there is nothing all that unique about Ferguson, Missouri. That if it blows up there, it's just at the edge of blowing up in countless other similarly organized parts of our society, and there are many of them. How do we understand this from an economics perspective, and what are we going to do? Well, let's go back. The last time we imposed seriously deteriorating economic conditions on our population was in the transition from the 1920s to the 1930s, the so-called Great Depression. And in that period of time, we created explosive situations for millions and millions of African American, white, and all Americans across the country. And we had an interesting response then, which was organization. We don't have that yet now. But then we had organization, as I mentioned, CIOs, socialist parties, communist parties. And they succeeded in getting some real reforms. For example, the Diaz colony with Johnny Cash that I spoke to you about at the beginning of today's program. Real reforms, social security, minimum wages, unemployment compensation, and a federal hiring program. An impressive set of reforms that the reformers of the time thought would solve the problem. They were wrong. That is, they were right that those reforms helped people in important ways, but they were wrong that they would be a solution. Why? Because if you don't change the underlying system, all you do is reform it, you create the possibility that people 5, 10, 15 years later, people in power, will undo the reforms because you've left them in power, because you've left a system that can take back the reforms it gives. There is no guarantee by changing the system that you can't go back to that. That was a bitter lesson learned. By the 1960s, we were ready to learn the lesson again. We had a decline in the conditions of mass of people. We had a bitterness as the poor found themselves falling further and further behind those better off. Even if the poor's condition was better in the 60s than it was in the 30s, which it mostly was, the gap between where we are and where we could be, where many of us are and where a few of us are, becomes intolerable. So the society blew up again in the 1960s, around the civil rights movement, around radical student movements, and so on. And once again, we had reforms. We had all the civil rights reforms. We had the war on poverty of President Johnson. And again, the reforms that were provided were important. They helped a whole bunch of people. But in the subsequent period of time, they were again undone. They were maneuvered around. They were taken back. Here we are in 2014. What Ferguson, Missouri shows us is that if all we do now is look at this situation and again say, wow, it's unfair. Wow, the police overreacted. Wow, the suffering of the majority of people in Ferguson, Missouri is unjustifiable in a rich society, doubly unjustifiable in a society that gives the top 20% the kinds of increase over the last 5 years I just described, and the bottom 20% become poorer still at the same time. This is intolerable. But if all we do is another set of reforms, then shame on us. We haven't learned the obvious lesson. You have to change the system that functions in this country. the whole way our politics and our economics are organized. Because if you want an economic system that serves the people of a society, then you have to put the people in charge. And that doesn't mean electing someone who goes off to the State House or to Washington to make rules and forgets where he or she came from. No, it means changing things at the base of society. And the place that needs to be changed, first and foremost, is the workplace. If the people who work in a factory, an office, a store, were to become, as they always should have been, the people who make the decisions in a democratic way, one person, one vote. If there are 400 people in the office, they vote on the basic decisions of that enterprise. That way, that enterprise will serve the people who work there. If you allow the customers to have a role, which I think you should, well, then it will be a decision partly made by the workers democratically and partly made by the customers democratically. We don't have that in this country. We have a tiny group of major shareholders and the boards of directors they select. They make the decisions. And then we claim to be surprised that the decisions they make are what's good for them. For the dividends they earn, for the profits they gather, sure. That's who's recovering in our economy. The rest of us aren't, and that's because we don't control the economic system. We allow it to control us. Unless we change that inside every enterprise, we will continue this periodic explosion and all the pain and suffering that it implies and produces for us. It's a wake-up call. The question is whether or not we are able to heed its message. Okay, I want to turn now and introduce to you a guest that I have today. His name is James Russell. I'm going to call him Jim because he has given me the go-ahead to do that. And as introduction, let me tell you a little bit about him. He's a professor of sociology at Eastern Connecticut State University. He's the author of 8 books, including, and I'm going to hold this up for the TV audience, Social Insecurity, 401ks, and the Retirement Crisis. And indeed, what I've asked him to come and talk with us about is the crisis facing our retirement system and therefore facing every American family. Because whether or not you're at the age when retirement is already a reality or imminent, even if you're not, you have parents and others that you care about who are. And therefore, that will affect you directly or indirectly if there is this crisis that he's going to speak about. But I was particularly interested in bringing Jim on because he was the leader of a successful rank-and-file union drive that won for the Connecticut State Public Employees the precedent-setting right to switch from their inferior 401k-like retirement plan to the state's pension system, even though the right wing in Connecticut worked very hard to prevent exactly that. I wanted Jim then to tell us about the crisis and to tell us about what working people proved able to do to at least make that crisis less burdensome on them. And clearly my hope is that what happened in Connecticut is something that can happen across the country. So, Jim, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks a lot, Richard. This is a real pleasure for me to be here.
Good. Let me start then. Tell me and tell my audience, what do you mean by a retirement crisis here in the United States? What is that?
Well, if we look at the latest statistics of people who are approaching retirement age, who are over 55, most of them, if they have any retirement plan at all beyond Social Security, have a 401k-like plan, which is a situation that has developed since around 1981. Before 1981, most people who had plans had traditional pensions, but then we've had this massive transformation in the United States. The whole idea of the 401k is that you would save up enough money to finance your retirement. Well, the latest statistics show us that this group of people who are approaching retirement will get the average person will get no more than $4,000 a year in retirement. So these 401k plans.
Stop.
Sure.
I'm an economist, so
okay.
I freak out at this. Say that again. The 401ks that were created to supplement Social Security for workers are going to bring them no more than $4,000 on average, $4,000 a year?
That's correct, according to the latest statistics on it. And it's a sum that is vastly inferior to what they would have had if they had been in a traditional pension. And that's the big turnaround that has occurred over the last 34 years in the United States.
Let's get right into that. Tell me how that would differ. What would have happened if they had kept to the traditional pensions? How were they different from these new ones that they shifted on to?
Well, with the traditional pension, number one is you had a guaranteed result. There are different ways in which that occurred. In most cases, they would multiply the number of years that you worked by some percentage by your final salary, and that was your guaranteed benefit. And the employer had to come up with that, okay? And so that was there. Well, beginning in 1981, they shifted it around so the employers didn't have to guarantee anything. And that really set up a situation where employers could hand over their retirement contributions to the financial services industry, which could then start pulling out commissions, administrative fees, and all sorts of other things. And the employer had no responsibility, no fiduciary and any other kind of responsibility. In addition, employers could, if they wanted to, reduce their contributions. So that and a number of other reasons means that these things are just not well funded for when people approach retirement.
So that the employer, so the employer could reduce the amount of money put into the 401k.
35% of them did that in response to 2008.
Wow. And likewise, many more fees and commissions were deducted once you went to the 401k system
exactly.
Compared to what had been done when the state administered a fund with a simple formula guaranteeing to you a certain percentage of your last year's income.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So this was good for the employer because they could save money by reducing these contributions if and when it suited them?
Well, it's interesting because it's not entirely good for the employer. If an employer wants to, is really concerned about the workers and what they'll receive in retirement and wants to achieve a certain goal, it's actually cheaper for the employer to do it through a regular pension plan than through these 401k things. Okay, but if the employer doesn't care what happens to the worker, then yeah, it's a better deal to just make a contribution to a 401k and then, you know, they're through with any responsibility.
Right. And that allows the commercialized financial management industry in the country, the people who manage the 401k plans, to begin dipping in there for all kinds of fees and commissions, which means the end result of what you get is as low as you indicate.
Well, and I think you know this as well as I do, that since the 1980s, the financial services industry has expanded enormously in the United States. And a good part of the fuel that drove that expansion was getting control over these retirement funds.
Yes. And also add that there was a significant effort, hasn't been achieved yet, but it's still an ongoing effort, to privatize the Social Security system as well, to do to that federal program what was done basically to the private pensions of so many workers.
Absolutely, because Social Security is the biggest competitor to the financial services industry in terms of control of the retirement savings of Americans.
Right. Okay, so tell me a little bit about what happened in Connecticut facing this situation. What did the people of Connecticut do? Why did they move in a unique way that we need to hear about?
Well, it's a really interesting story because I think most people think that it's inevitable that we're going into 401ks, and we actually went in the opposite direction. We went from a 401k-like plan to a traditional pension. I would say back in the early 1990s, I first looked at this carefully because one of the things that gave me an advantage to look at it is that where I worked, there were both types of plans. So if you wanted to, you could compare the benefits. Okay, and I had been assured that the 401k-like plan was the better plan. But when I actually sat down and compared the benefits, I was shocked. We were paying twice as much in contributions, yet would receive half as much in benefits. Okay, and
how was that possible? Can you help us understand?
Sure. With the traditional pension, it had the advantage that, number one, it had professional investors. Okay, it didn't have rank amateurs, which most people in 401ks are. Okay, it also had the advantage that it operates like Social Security, so it has all the advantages of social insurance. Okay, so that meant that, let's say, someone had been putting money into the system, they retire, and then they die. Okay, what happens to the money? It stays in the system to benefit people who are still living, same way as Social Security. So the short-lived subsidize the long-lived. None of that happens with 401ks. And with 401ks, I mean, you first off, you have all this money that's being pulled out by the administrators of it. Minimally, people lose a quarter, and I'm saying minimally, lose a quarter of what they gain in a 401k through all of these fees. Right, so you know, in the accumulation phase of it, then what I think a lot of people don't understand about 401ks is what you're supposed to do with the money when you actually do retire. Okay, the way they were originally set up, you were supposed to purchase an annuity from a life insurance company, which would be like a pension. You would give them a certain amount of money, and then they would guarantee an income for the rest of your life. Which the principle is good, but the life insurance companies are profit-making companies, so they pull out as much as they can from these things too. So it ends up, they've got you coming and going. They've got you in the accumulation phase and then in the spend-down phase, whereas with the traditional pensions, since it's guaranteed, the employer has to make sure that it works. They can do that.
Because the employer has to deliver a predefined sum of money
Absolutely.
To a working person when he or she retires, and they can't really waiver. That's their responsibility. It's part of the job contract they have with their employees.
Plus, they're dealing with a group of people. They're not dealing individual. So there are all kinds of savings when you're doing it as a large pool of people. And then the whole social insurance part that I was talking about.
Tell us
before.
A little bit, before we go on our break, tell us a little bit about how the people in Connecticut came to understand and move against what was happening.
Well, so when I figured this out, to my shock, in the early 1990s.
As a professor, as a public employee in Connecticut.
Right. I would start to tell people about it. And their eyes would glaze over. They would kind of check their watches. They really didn't want to hear it. Okay, they thought either I was crazy, because they all believed that they were getting very rich in these accounts. And I pretty much gave up. Then 2008 happened, when people on average lost a quarter of their accumulations, and that's what woke people up. And so we were able to, I and some other people, were able to put together some meetings. It turned out people were very scared and very concerned. We started a committee on our small campus. We quickly outgrew that campus, became a statewide committee, had a website. I went talking all over the place. And then the unions responded. Because we put, it was a...
The public employee unions?
Public employee unions. This was a movement of rank and file, not, it wasn't started by the unions, but it was rank and file members that grouped about seven or eight different unions. And then we put pressure on them. they brought a grievance against the state of Connecticut because what we wanted was the right to move from the 401k-like plan
back into a conventional pension.
Into a real pension plan. One of the things that I think is really interesting about this is that when you sign up for one of these plans, as we did in Connecticut, they didn't tell us it was an irrevocable choice. So if a year later you wanted to change, you couldn't. You know, now, how many things in life are like that?
Right.
I mean, you can get out of a bad marriage, you can get out of a house, you should be able to get out of a retirement plan.
Right.
But once they get you, it's like they've got you. And so we were contesting that irrevocable feature, and we won the grievance. But then, the state hired some lawyers who had a connection with the financial services company that was administering the plans, and they did a dirty trick. They required that we get an Internal Revenue Service authorization, which can take up to 7 years. Okay. Well, to make a long story short, we were able to overcome that obstacle, okay, and we ended up getting a new plan that was designed. And so by 2012, we were able to shift if we wanted to.
And so a large number of Connecticut and public employees were able to revoke the irrevocable,
right,
cancel the 401k, and go back into a state pension.
Yeah, some 1,200 so far. The opportunity is still open. Over $100 million has rolled from ING, which administers the 401k, back into the state of Connecticut, into the pension fund.
Okay, we're going to take our short mid-program break. We'll be back in literally a few seconds. Please stay with us. We'll continue this important conversation on the retirement crisis in the United States. Welcome back, folks. This is Economic Update. We're back from our mid-program break and ready to resume our interview with Jim Russell, a professor of sociology at Eastern Connecticut State University, the author of a book, Social Insecurity, basically outlining that the 401k plans that so many of my listeners, so many Americans have in many, many cases been a really bad idea for the people who have them, even though it's been a useful ploy for employers to reduce their pension contributions on the one hand, and for the financial services industry to make a lot of money on fees and commissions that they couldn't have made if people had stayed with conventional pensions. So in returning, Jim, let me ask you to tell us a little bit about what was involved in Connecticut in the movement as it developed? What were the issues, in a sense, that you found compelling for people?
Well, I went all over the state talking to people. And so I got every imaginable question. But I would say the top question that I got was, well, isn't it true that the state is going broke, so we'll never see this money? Okay, and no, it's not true. There's an enormous misunderstanding of what's going on in pension funds in this country, and it's quite intentional because since the late 1970s, very conservative think tanks have tried to undermine people's confidence in, what, first, Social Security, and second, the pensions that still exist. Most public employees in the United States still have pensions. It's the private sector that has had this dramatic decrease.
Right.
And so they're trying to kind of wipe the species out and make
right.
it extinct. And one of the ways they're doing it is to try to convince people that these things financially don't work. And so they say, well, they have these huge unfunded liabilities. Okay, and so that's a very scary term. Okay, but if you actually look into what it means, it's not at all what you think it means. It means that if a pension fund were to stop cold, get no more contributions, and it had to pay all of the people the total that was due to them who had retired, all the people who were still working, okay, how much of that could it pay? Okay, well, it could pay 40% of that, 50%, 60%, you know, whatever it is. Okay, that's not going to happen.
Right.
Okay, so you don't have to worry about that. But even, you know, if it were going to happen, okay, there's no imminent crisis. Okay, these funds can go on and on and on with 80%. You know, certainly with 80% is considered a healthy funding ratio.
Right.
They can go on with 40%, 30%. There's no imminent crisis. Now, that shouldn't be going dramatically in the direction of, you know, losing their reserve. Okay, but so anyway, you know, that was, we had to overcome that fear that people had. Okay, that because the airways are just polluted with all of this type of talk about public employees and their pensions and all of that.
I have figured out with other guests how to explain what you just said in a slightly different way. I think that the fear of the business community and of the wealthy in the United States is that a day may come when there will be difficulty paying people's pensions. And the solution will be obvious, that either you take care of the millions of Americans who've given a lifetime of work. Let's remember, a pension is part of what you got paid that you deferred until you were retired.
Mm-hmm.
If you hadn't had that deference, you would have gotten paid more money all the years along the way, but you took a portion out of your pay and had that put into a pension. It's part of what you're owed and part of what you worked for. So if a time actually came when there wasn't enough money to pay that, you'd have the millions of people saying, that's my pay for a lifetime of work, that has to be honored. And the way to pay for that would be to go tax the corporations and the rich, who, by not paying taxes all along, were mostly responsible for there not being enough money in the first place. And if you ever put it to the population, millions of people who need a pension that they have worked for and earned versus not taxing corporations and the rich, I think the corporations and the rich know real well which way that is going to go. They're going to have to pay. So better at this point to stop the whole process, not to get to that key point of struggle, and they can erode it slowly over time, they'll never face that moment when they could be called to account for what they've done.
Well, here's the beauty of that from their point of view. Okay, if you're in a 401k and you arrive at retirement and you don't have enough money, okay, who do you blame? Yourself.
That's right.
I didn't save enough. I didn't invest skillfully enough. I should have gotten an advisor. There's no one to blame but myself. And we're getting that steadily now. You need to save more. Save, save, save. It's right. This crusade that's all over the
yeah,
place.
It's all about your decisions and
right.
your
fault. You're responsible
that's
for it.
Right.
If you have a pension, on the other hand, okay, and you come and there's some problem with the pension, you're going to unite with the other people who are in
same.
The pension fund. And that happened in Connecticut when they were not funding the state teachers' pension. Teachers got together, put pressures on the legislature, and indeed the legislature, you know, found the funds. They had to do that. So,
yeah,
I mean, I agree with you.
It's about struggle. It's about motivations and understanding the crisis that's building, maybe a little bit ahead of the next guy. Okay, so what can other people do? What can the people listening to this program in states across the United States, hearing what was done in Connecticut, seeing what the issues are, what advice would you give?
Well, the first thing is I think you have to really understand the situation that you're in. You have to really understand what these plans are, which was why I wrote this book, because ours was a story within a story. It was a story of what we did in Connecticut, but it was also the larger context of the shift from pensions to 401ks in the United States, but also a story of international developments in which the same year that 401ks started in the United States, Chile, under a right-wing dictatorship, basically made a 401k for the whole country. Of course, they didn't have that name for it. Okay, so you need to understand this. But secondly, I think there are things that people can do if they're creative about it. You know, nobody handed that to us in Connecticut. We had to figure that out. And all kinds of people said, you can't do this, it's impossible, it's illegal, it's this, it's that. Well, nobody had ever tried it. So there are a lot of things I think that can be done. Certainly one of the things everybody needs to do is to protect Social Security, because that's the backdrop that all of us have. And I can tell you that elites in both the Democratic and Republican Party want to erode Social Security. That's why we've had regressive reforms come up under both Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah, and I think also that people may want to remember, when the stock market crashes in 2008 and takes down the value of your 401k drastically, it didn't touch Social Security. Social Security had didn't even wobble in 2000. No one said, ooh, Social Security. The same people who have always raised alarms about Social Security, who want to scare everybody, who want to justify getting rid of it, tell the story about how it would have been better if you hadn't had Social Security, but you had 401ks. Lord help this country if at the time 2008, when the stock market crashed, if we had had all of our savings for retirement in a 401k, we wouldn't have recovered. It would have been awful what happened to us compared to Social Security. Something to keep in mind, even if you don't know the details of Social Security, which, by the way, show us that not only is it solvent now, and not only has it got all the money it needs for at least the next couple decades, but if it finally overcame its blinders, its refusal to levy the tax on incomes above $113,000 a year, thereby exempting all those wealthy people from paying what they ought to pay, if it stopped exempting dividend and capital gains income from the levy, which they do now, but which they don't have to do, if they had a progressive Social Security rate rather than a regressive one, there's more possibilities to change Social Security to make it secure for the rest of this century than we need. But it's always a political question, who's going to foot the bill? And the rich don't want to pay what would otherwise be required, and what indeed they do pay in other societies, capitalist societies like ours, where the balance of forces between working people and the corporations and the rich is different from what we have here. Well, anyway, I interrupted you. Some more about what people can do.
One of the things that I write about in the book is that if you want to understand what the elites want to do about Social Security, you have to go back to a World Bank publication in 1994 called Averting the Old Age Crisis, which spells out the need to shift people away from what are called defined benefit pensions into these 401k-like plans. And it would like to see national programs like Social Security moved into these plans. So you seem to have three plans that are going on, an A, B, C. Plan A is to privatize it. Bush tried. Okay, the pushback was enormous. He had to give up. Okay, B was what Obama tried, which was to cut the benefits, to cut the cost of living adjustment. The pushback was enormous, so they had to abandon that. What I fear is Plan C, which is some of what you were talking about, is that according to the trustees, that if nothing is done, by 2032, one or 2 years from there, that the plan will have to reduce benefits. Okay, so plan C may be to do nothing, right? Okay, yet, as you indicate, the reforms that could make Social Security fully solvent and be able to actually expand to address some of these issues of 401ks by expanding it are simple, including, you know, raising the limit on the amount that's taxed. Also, very interesting, the type of income, because it's only labor income that's taxed, not property income.
Right. And a fully socialized social insurance, if the point of Social Security is to provide security to our society, which is what the name says, then the notion of exempting property income,
right,
dividends, interest, capital gains, is a peculiar decision and one that nakedly reveals whose interests are governing here. Jim, thank you very, very much. I hope that my listeners will not only heed the message of what's wrong with our retirement system and the crisis, but even more the message that something can be done, that don't be deterred when you are told nothing can be done. Exactly. The whole message of what your book is about and your work is about is that, starting with a few people, the public employees of Connecticut changed it. What was irrevocable turned out not to be. What was unchangeable turned out to be changeable. And there are thousands of people making that shift right now and getting themselves to a much better place. Yeah. Thank you very much,
Jim. Thanks a lot, Rick. It's been my pleasure.
In our final 10 minutes, I'm going to respond to your questions, as I always try to do. And the first one has to do with Walmart. Walmart comes up often in your emails to me. I'm not surprised. After all, Walmart is the largest single private employer in the United States. It touches many of our lives in countless ways. And so here was a question. Is it true that Walmart depends on food stamps? And I chuckled when I saw that, but I realized this was an important and a very thoughtful question. So let me try to answer. In the latest annual report of Walmart, as reported on by Bloomberg, again on August 19th, at Bloomberg Financial Services, the latest Walmart annual report warns that if the food stamp program, today called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP for short, if the SNAP program ever experienced large spending cuts, its results would be hurt. That's Walmart saying its profits depend on food stamps. Last year, Walmart had about $279 billion in sales in the United States, half of that from groceries. What they're saying is the Walmart customer is a customer highly likely to be using food stamps, as one in six American families now do, and that therefore Walmart would be seriously impacted in its profits if the government cut food stamps in any significant way, much as the Republicans in Congress have recently tried to do. So yes, Walmart as a corporation is significantly impacted, that's their own statement, by the food stamp program. Or to say the same thing in the harsh economic reality terms that I prefer, the federal government subsidizes Walmart by means of food stamps. That's how the government subsidizes the purchase of Walmart commodities. But in fact, Walmart is subsidized in many ways. And I want to go over them briefly with you because I want to drive home the point too infrequently made that major corporations whose leaders love to talk about the need to cut back subsidies for poor people and for farmers and for a whole host of recipients are in fact major recipients themselves. They just don't want you to know. But I do, so let's go. First, we have kept our minimum wage law in the United States low for many years, much lower than, say, France or Britain or Germany or Australia. I've done that on this program. You know we are much, much lower than them. Who benefits from that? Walmart. Because Walmart can pay much lower wages to its workers than would otherwise be possible if we had a minimum wage simply at roughly the same rate that other countries like us impose. So the Walmart profits are shaped by the low minimum wage kept low in this country. Second, and this got quite a bit of publicity a year or so ago, Medicaid doesn't offer many of its part-time workers any kind of medical insurance. With their low pay and the absence of insurance, they go on Medicaid. Medicaid is a government-paid-for medical insurance program. Walmart doesn't have to provide medical insurance because its low-paid employees have a government-subsidized alternative. That's very good for Walmart, because otherwise it would come under heavy pressure from low-paid workers to provide some sort of medical insurance. Actually, another part of the list is food stamps again. This time, food stamps, because Walmart can get away with paying workers very low because they can then qualify for food stamps, have more to spend on food than they would if they just got their wage. So Walmart is able to get away with a low wage better than it otherwise might because the government comes in and helps those people with food stamps, which then millions of Americans turn around and use to buy Walmart products. So Walmart wins twice with the food stamps program. Maybe that's part of the reason why Republican efforts to smash food stamps were markedly less successful than their efforts to cut other programs, because they had Walmart on the other side. Last subsidy, and I could go on all day. Last subsidy the government provides Walmart. The United States government has opened itself up to China. It engages the Chinese in a largely open-ended economic relationship. This was crucial. If the United States had kept China at bay, if the tensions between the United States and China had led to all kinds of laws and barriers, it would have been very hard for Walmart. Why? Because one of the most important, probably the most important way that the Chinese low-wage goods get into the American market is by means of Walmart. Walmart is the merchant for China in the United States, the number one. It is the way Chinese goods get sold to Americans. Without Walmart handling all those Chinese goods, you couldn't have had the industrialization of China that we now look at. So China and Walmart have been close partners, and the openness of the United States to China politically was a major subsidy to Walmart and its growth. The next time someone tells you private enterprise succeeding without government help, ridicule them. Finally, in the little bit of time we have left, you've asked me to talk about the advertising industry. And I admit I haven't done that, and so it's very good that you brought that to my attention, and I will be doing that in the weeks ahead. But here's an opener in the time that we have. According to Zenith Optimedia, it's a company that keeps track of these things, and as reported in the Consumer Reports magazine for June of 2014, total U.S. ad expenditures in 2012, the last full year for which I could find data, was $161.2 billion. That is a staggering amount of money. That's the amount of money we spend, $161.2 billion, to tell each other, or rather to have the business community tell us, why we should buy what they produce. Let's be real clear. Advertising doesn't produce goods and services. Advertising is the employment of hundreds of thousands of some of our most creative people in coming up with gimmicks, claims, packaging that will get us to buy what we otherwise might not have bought. That's why advertising occurs, because a company believes that it can sell more goods if it has devoted some effort to convincing you that they're worthwhile than it could if it didn't. Many companies do it even though they don't believe in it because their competitors do it. we get the really crazy situation that because company A is advertising, company B that makes the same good now feels it has to match that advertising. Otherwise, what company A is claiming will lead consumers to buy its products and ignore company B. So even if company B wouldn't have done it otherwise, it's forced to by the decision of anybody in an industry to advertise, they all do. And here's perhaps the most important economic and political and cultural consequence of advertising. And I ask you to think about this. When we encounter issues in our lives as human beings, we try to remember there are two sides to questions. We try to understand that we want to get multiple perspectives on a problem. We want to see alternative ways of understanding so that we can come to our own conclusion by weighing the alternatives. Advertising pollutes the world of thought because what advertisers do is hammer you with whatever they can think of, real or imagined, that's good about a product, and hide from you everything that's negative. You don't get two sides. You're made to believe that there is only one side, that it's good, 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 good. You know better, and therefore you either don't believe advertising, or maybe you begin to think of everybody as hustling you. The ability of human beings to think critically is undermined by the one-sided, endless chorus of self-congratulations that we call advertising. But as I said, I will come back and talk more about advertising both next week and in following sessions. We've come to the end of our program. Thank you very, very much. I want to thank Jim Russell again for joining us. This is Economic Update. Richard Wolff, please join me again next week.
My time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.